as I realize that all this stuff is very new to you, most of you. So, just like 5 minutes. She was born in 1910 in the Ukraine and came to the U.S. with her family as a preteen. Here she joined the Young Communists and then the Trotskyist Party. She worked with Trotsky in Mexico, 1937-38, breaking with him over the nature of the Soviet Union and going on to develop her theory of state capitalism. In the 1940s, she and C.L.R. James, also known as Johnson, formed the Johnson Forest Tendency, which broke with Trotskyism's traditional party forms and programs and philosophy. She was extremely active in the 1949-50 general strike in the coal mines in the U.S., and she later dated the birth of Marxist humanism to that strike. And there's a pamphlet called The Coal Miners' General Strike and the Birth of Marxist Humanism that was published in 1984. The pamphlet is in full on the archives page of the MHI website. Contains both the story of the strike and her essay on, quote, the emergence of a new movement from practice that is itself a form of theory. So this was 1984, and the preface says, it's crucial to grasp this historic struggle as signaling both the opposition of the workers to the new stage of production, that's automated miner, which has taken the form of a continuous miner, and the opening of a whole new stage of cognition. When they faced the monster they called the man-killer and asked, quote, what kind of labor should man do? Why should there be a division between mental and manual labor? Close quote. So now we come to her June 12 and 20, 1953 letters, where the earliest in our readings for tonight. And they're letters to her co-leaders, C.L.R. James, also known as Johnson, and Grace Lee. And in them, she's, well, you're about to all say what she does in them. But obviously, she sees Hegel speaking to the issues they've been dealing with, including those generated by the miners' strike and the questions of organization that have arisen. In the letters, she singles out the dual movements from practice to theory and theory to practice. She pursues Hegel much further. While James and Lee went in other ways, the Johnson Forest Tendency broke up, and in 1955, Dunayevskaya formed her own organization. And you can, again, find many of her writings and discussions of her books, etc., on the MHI website, the archives page, and the literature page. Dunayevskaya termed the 1953 letters to be her actual break with C.L.R. James. For the rest of her life, she returned again and again to these letters as the source in embryo of the philosophy she elaborated. In the 1980s, when she summed up the ramifications of the 1953 letters, as we see in these readings from the 80s, she called them her, quote, philosophic moment, which she defines on pages 5 and 6 of Kahn, Power and Negativity. And she continued to develop what she called, quote, the many universals inherent in them. Dissatisfied with her own organization and calling the subject of organization a, quote, void in Marxism ever since the Critique of the Gotha Program, she was working on a book about organization at the time of her death, in 1987. We have this June 1 draft of what would have been her last talk to the organization about that, and we have essays from the last few years of her life, including several on these issues, what she called, quote, retrospective perspective. And we have her notes to herself in preparation for the book. Will you see that Dave B. needs to be called again? Will? let's turn to the study questions. I don't want to preempt them, just that some people might be a little shaky on the historic setting for all this. We're going to address the study questions in the order that we rearranged them in last night. I hope everyone saw it. On Tuesday, we had sent out 15 for the two classes, today and the last one next Sunday. But we decided we should not do them in that order. So I'm going to give you the numbers that they originally had and read them out. And we'll see how far we get. There's no particular rule on that for today. But please do remember to mute your mic, speak directly into your mic, and to call out your name when you wish to speak, and to say over when you're done. Now, I want to make a special effort today to hear from everyone, because some people haven't spoken much at all. So I'm not going to call on you if you've already spoken until we see what others have to say about the questions. Since much of this material is new and we want to make it as clear as possible, I will endeavor to see that the questions get addressed, and I will limit answers to about 3 minutes each so we can get everyone's take on it. We have next week to continue this discussion, so please exercise some self-discipline in how often and long you speak or ask to speak. Okay, so let's start with question number two, which begins inauspiciously with a typo in the date of the letter, okay, in the in what we sent out. It's the letter is May 12, 1953, not 13. And near the start of it, Dunayevskaya writes that she is, quote, not concerned with spontaneity versus organization, nor with Stalinism, close quote. And in Power Negativity, this is on page 16. So the first question, 2A, is, what is she concerned with? Speakers, please. Will, I think we just lost another David. Or the same one, I don't know.
That David was never actually connected, I don't think.
Oh, all right. I'm going to shut up and let you handle it.
But, this is Brendan.
Hi, Brendan.
Says she's concerned with the dialectic of the Vanguard Party and its relationship to the mass. Or, sorry, the masses. I don't know if you want more from me, but that, I think, is the short answer. Over.
Someone else want to take a stab or elaborate on that?
I'm happy to speak on it, Ravi.
Okay, Ravi.
There's quite a lot which she's interested in. I mean, she's concerned with the incompleteness of theoretical insights of the intellectuals, and also the incompleteness of the workers' awareness of what they face in striving to transform their own conditions of life. And it's the two sides of incompleteness that beg the question of how they can be overcome. And she says that both sides are incomplete. It's not simply that theorists have the answers which the masses must learn from, which is how she characterizes the Vanguard Party, but instead it's the theorists must be conscious of their own necessarily limited conceptions, which can only be overcome from the vantage point of the workers having already made a revolution. So in that sense, theory must project beyond itself to even understand why it is one-sided in the here and now. And it's only in the movement to create the yet-to-be-achieved future that an understanding of our present limitations is possible. And so it's this sense that there is a positive within the negative, but it's the positive sort of future unity that is only possible by the negation of our sublimiting existing society. And theory cannot rest on the facts of what exists today, but must anticipate the reality of tomorrow and capture the movement towards it. And in that sense, it's a rejection of positivism which says that only the existing is real, but rather she takes from Hegel and Marx, who say that the yet to be realized is also real. And it's in the movement of history that we need to look at its full course of development and not arbitrarily cut it off at where we are now. I think I'll leave it there. Over.
Ravi, can I? I wasn't sure if I heard one thing right. Did you say that that it's one-sided until the revolution? This split in the dialectic.
I'm saying that the the theorists must be conscious of their own necessarily limited conception, because it's the split in mental and manual labour, and the theory must account for its own limitations in the way that it's divided. So theory has to project beyond itself even to understand why it is one-sided in the here and now. Over.
Okay, so would someone else like to come in on this question?
Andrew?
Yes, Andrew.
Yeah, just to elaborate a bit on what Brendan said, she says the dialectic of the Vanguard Party, and then she includes within that a small grouping like ours, and she later says it doesn't really matter whether we're large or small, and its relationship to the mass. They've broken from the concept of the Vanguard Party in a certain sense, right, at least politically. So I don't think it should be understood as meaning either that they were vanguardists because they weren't, or that this is some non-vanguardist critique of, or looking from the outside in on vanguardism. Over.
I'll call myself. Yeah, I was going to say basically what Andrew said. I think that she could have used some more punctuation. it was just a letter, but yeah, I think she's setting up three different kinds of groups: the Vanguard Party, which they've already rejected. But she keeps using the word party when she means organizations out of habit. The masses outside of any party, the movements of workers and others that will ultimately make the revolution. And the small group like us, which someone had asked on the email what she was talking about, well, they were called the Johnson Forest Tendency, as I said earlier, and they were a small group. And they were trying to work out something new. And the question she's posing is, how come there are always these small groups or small parties involved in revolutionary activity, and what is their role and what is their objectivity? She calls it the objectivity of subjectivity, and what role can they play? And just in response to Ravi, I don't think that she's only talking about how the dialectic will play itself out in the future society. I think she's very concerned with how it's playing itself out now and how we can learn from it to guide our own activity and figure out what our own role is.
I didn't say that. I said that it's the anticipation of the future society that's necessary to see the limitations of where we are now.
Oh, definitely. definitely, absolutely. The perspective of the new society governs everything, and that's why she's enamored with the absolute idea as containing that ultimate relationship between reality and the ideal. Anyway, who else would like the floor, if anyone? Okay, let's go on to B. B is why. I guess we have already touched on that. But why is she concerned with the dialectic of grouping like ours, small or large, or a party, and its relationship to the outside masses?
Yeah, I'd like to say...
Go ahead.
Can you hear me? My mic wasn't working so well last week.
You sound great to me.
Okay, good.
All right.
I mean, one thing immediately in terms of this question would be about what she's concerned with, as to why she's so concerned with the question of the dialectic of the party, is that by this point, Boris Johnson had broken with the Trotskyist movement and had formed an independent group in the correspondence committees. And you know, they rejected the Vanguard Party, so they're now faced with the question of organization. She brings up the year 1948 a couple of times in this letter, and she says she reiterates that it's not 1948 but 1953. The year 1948 is a reference to C.L.R. James's notes on dialectics, according to the editors point that out in one of the footnotes. In the notes on dialectics, James he had already explored the dialectic of the party, and in the process of that, he posits organization and spontaneity as absolute opposites. He says, and I'm paraphrasing, he says, you know nothing about organization unless at every step you relate to its opposite, namely spontaneity. So I think James locates spontaneity as the opposite of the Vanguard Party. And with that, his exploration of the dialectic of the party, it comes to an end. It's been exhausted. So then all that really remained for intellectuals, in James's view, was then, to record the spontaneous activity of the workers. I don't think that Zunitskaya was at all satisfied with that. And she was trying to work out a new position here. You can see this already in the dispute, in her dispute with James and Grace Lee over the miner strike and the hamburger recipe thing. In the 1949-50 miner strike, which Anne discusses a bit already. I think what impresses her is not the spontaneous activity of the workers or their autonomy from the union bureaucrats, the kind of stuff that did impress James. I think that it's what impresses her is actually the thoughts of the workers, and that they were posing the question of. And there was some discussion of this on the email too. The question of what kind of labor human beings should perform. The implication of that is that like their thought was, and this is independently of any kind of enlightenment from the Vanguard Party, their thought was it was reaching toward second negativity, or rather, it was reaching toward a new society. I think she felt that this posed a real challenge for I guess what you call now, like now, movement intellectuals, so a challenge for movement intellectuals, and she felt that challenge needed to be met. The thing is that it opened up the possibility for a new kind of dialogue between workers and intellectuals. I mean, much like James, she recognized that workers they already have socialist consciousness, independent of a vanguard party bringing to them, but she didn't think that it was. That was enough, right? I mean, she didn't think it was enough to kind of stand by passively and take notes on the workers' activity. She felt like a Marxist organization has something more to offer. I think that that something more that she felt an organization had to offer has to do with ideas. And you know, like eventually she'd come to see this mean ideas like a libertary vision of a new society and the actual measures that we needed to reach it based in, you know, Marx's growth and critique. But I don't know. I mean, the thing is that the ideas don't come like fully formed. They have to be worked out. And I think she thought that they had to be worked out in a kind of active dialogue with the spontaneous movements. She was pointing to a path beyond the old sort of split or, you know, binary between the Vanguard Party and spontaneity. Over.
Okay. Good. What time is it? Let's move on to C, which is still part of question two. Okay. So the question is, was what is she concerned with, why, and now can it or how can it be decoupled from the issue of, quote, spontaneity versus organization? What is she addressing in this letter on decoupling the issue of spontaneity versus organization from what this small group should be doing? Who would like to try this one?
Jones.
Okay. Peter. Okay. Would someone else like to address this? I'm going to wait a minute and see if y'all could collect your thoughts.
This is Stephanie.
Oh, okay, Stephanie.
I'm totally unprepared. I'm still reading, but I want to read something that maybe will help. I don't know if I understand it, but I'm going to take a stab at reading it, but it's not very long, okay? And maybe it'll point to something. All right. So this is on page 17. Um, Okay, the other jump that I referred to, this is Dunayevskaya. The other jump that I referred to that I wish to make is to leave the logic for a moment and go to the last chapter in Hegel's Phenomenology. In that chapter on absolute knowledge, Hegel writes, "The object as a whole is the mediated result, the syllogism of the passing of universality into individuality through specification, as also the reverse process from individual to universal through canceled individuality or specific determination." Take a second look at the phrase, the mediated result, and remember that our object is the party and that we are working out the triangular relationship, not only politically, but philosophically, that syllogistically speaking, the party is the totality, the mediated result of the three layers, and at the same time, it is what it is by its relationship to the proletariat outside, on the one hand, and to the universal of socialism, on the other hand, except that the two are not now on the one hand and on the other hand, but interpenetrated. And I think this is a kind of maybe another way of stating or part of what Ravi was referring to earlier, over.
Stephanie, could you sort of translate that into plain English? What you think she's saying there?
I'll do my best, but I'm probably going to need kibitzing or some other kind of help because, as you know, I don't have the background. Well, I think what she's saying is that. There, things are not as opposed. I think what she's saying is things are not as opposed to one another as one might think from the outset, and that all of it has to work together somehow, whether it's at the beginning, the middle, or the end as we're moving towards communism. I mean, I don't know, but this is like just kind of a gut reaction. I'm going to just stop before I say anything else. If anyone wants to help me out, over.
Okay, anybody else on that point or any other point that answers the question of whether we can decouple the issues and organization she's addressing from the issue of spontaneity versus organization?
Andrew?
Yes, Andrew. Yes, Andrew.
May I speak? I've already spoken.
You've already, you're breaking up, so talk into the mic. I know you said you've already spoken. Well, let me see if anyone else wants to speak first. Hold on. Oh, stupid mic. Does anyone else want to address this? Or shall we give it to Andrew? Go ahead, Andrew, and then I'll address it too. You go first.
Yeah, I think that the key word there is versus. And I think what Seth said was, first of all, amazing. It should be written up and certainly made into an article, just as is, really. And you know, you can't get away from the issues of spontaneity or the mass movement and a group like ours. So, you know, you can't be unconcerned with that, but you can be unconcerned with or reject or move beyond the issue that these are the poles that one has to deal with, that these are, as he put it to Seth, these are absolute opposites. So I think that that's what she says she's not concerned. I think she's rejecting right there and trying, as he said, to look out, I'm getting tied up. She's basically rejecting C.L.R. James' notes on dialectics and that whole perspective, and she's looking for another approach, so to speak, in which spontaneity and organization are not opposites, while, however, you know, not moving back to Vanguard. Over.
Can I throw something in very quickly, Ravi?
Yes, Ravi.
She's also, well, in rejecting vanguardism, I'm assuming that it's not just the experience of being in the Socialist Workers' Party in the US, but she also rejects, on several occasions, Lenin's What Is to Be Done.
Ravi?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Sorry, Ravi, you're breaking up. Is anyone else having trouble hearing you?
And it's Paul. You know, I'm finding that it's not only Ravi who is breaking up, but Andrew, and even you're breaking up a bit. I wonder if maybe Will needs to be informed. Will?
You're breaking up. I can hear what you said at the end.
I don't think that's a connection issue, because it's not like it's freezing up and stuttering. It's more like there's a lot of static, which is probably people's microphones. Over.
All right, let's try. I'm guilty. I keep forgetting to mute myself because I'm chairing.
That might be it. It might be that everybody needs to keep double checking that they're muted.
Yeah, let's go another couple minutes and make sure we're all muting ourselves, and then. If there's a problem, speak up, though. But let's have Ravi start over again, and we'll see how it goes. Over.
Okay. Well, as I said, she's not only criticizing the experiences of being inside the Socialist Worker Party in the States, but it seems she's also a few times criticized Lenin's What Is to Be Done and the idea of the Vanguard Party as he articulated it then. And criticizes him for not ever changing that and never revisiting the question of organization. And I just want to quote from the online version of What Is to Be Done, which says that, page 69, it says, "Cannot such a task be carried out even by masses that do not struggle against the political police at all? Could this task, moreover, be fulfilled if, in addition to the few leaders, it were not undertaken by such workers, the overwhelming majority, as are incapable of struggling against the political police? Such workers, average people of the masses, are capable of displaying enormous energy and self-sacrifice in strikes and street battles with the police and troops, and are capable, in fact, are alone capable of determining the outcome of our entire movement. But the struggle against the political police requires special qualities. It requires professional revolutionaries, and we must see to it not only that masses advance concrete demands, but that the masses of the workers advance an increasing number of such professional revolutionaries." And is it? I'm trying to work out if she's objecting to that kind of sense in which sort of members of the working class and ordinary sort of workers from the masses have to learn to have to appropriate the proper level of theory in order to advance demands that are in a revolutionary direction, whether that's something that Dunevskaya was supposed to, and if so, why? I'm not quite sure what her basis for opposing the idea of the Vanguard Party is. Over.
This is Stephanie. Ravi, could you say what page you were reading from in what work of Dunevskaya's? I couldn't hear it at all. Over.
That was from What Is to Be Done. That is What Is to Be Done. And it was on the online version, page 69. In terms of where Dinesh Kaya says it, she says it loads. I think she even says it in chapter 11 of Rosa Luxemburg.
couple things. Oh, is the sound better now? Is anyone still having trouble with the sound?
I couldn't hear Ravi barely at all. I was really struggling. It sounds like there's a lot of interference there on the line. I don't know. Over.
It's Paul. It's not only that there's static on the line, it's really that the voice, all the voices seem to be breaking up intermittently. Over.
That's odd, because I'm not hearing that on my end, but perhaps I should start the call over.
yes,
is that something you'd like to do?
A groundswell for starting it over.
Okay.
So what do? We all hang up and wait to be called?
You don't do anything. I'll call everyone again. I'll hang up and call everyone again. Just you all will accept the call, all right?
All right, so we do nothing until it rings again.
Yeah.
Okay, Ravi was quoting from Lennon's What Is to Be Done and asking someone to distinguish what Donaevskaya is saying in critique of the Vanguard Party from what Lennon was saying. Is that correct, Ravi?
That's pretty much it, yeah.
All right, can everyone hear now that I've spoken for a while? Anyone still having trouble? Is everyone happy? Yes!
Yes!
Okay. All right. It's too much. Okay. let me say something, and then we'll have several questions on the table. Maybe other people will want to come in. I was trying to address the issue of spontaneity and organization not being opposites. So I wanted to say this, that even if they appear opposite in form, they're not opposite in content. We'll find this out later in her life, but Donaevskaya thinks that the real opposite is what philosophy these things are based on and not what form, outward form they take. So that she is proposing an organization based on that perspective of the future that Hegel's absolute idea of freedom represents. And she wants to see how it can play out in life, and she thinks there's a role for a small group like us or a big group like us to do theoretical work that, in fact, has a great interrelationship with the mass movement, but is not directing them, is not laying a foundation to direct them. But it's something else entirely. It's a different relationship. It's a relationship of developing ideas together. So she sees, this is a quote, "The absolute idea is the only object and content of philosophy. It's both object and content of philosophy. It contains every determinateness. So it doesn't remain as an abstraction. It plays itself out in theoretical development on every issue that comes up." Peter had mentioned overcoming Stalinism. She doesn't mean this doesn't need to be discussed and put out there, but she thinks it already is out there, that everybody knows by now, 1953, that the Soviet Union has become a monster and that that has to be overcome. But just as she wouldn't think it's the intellectuals' role to tell the workers how to revolt, she also wouldn't tell them how to get rid of Stalin. She certainly is warning them about the counter-revolution within the revolution, but she's not giving them a blueprint for getting rid of either private or state capitalism, which is what she considers Stalin. Who else wants to speak, over with me and someone else on this.
And I'd like to read just a... This is Mike.
Yes, Mike. I finally figured out that the line under your picture means you're speaking. Go ahead, Mike.
So, just plucking out one of the paragraphs in this letter where it seems that she's addressing the question of the party or the group, which is helpful to me because I was kind of confused a little bit about that. She writes on page 18, this is in the middle, in the party both as political organization and as the realization of the theory of knowledge, the form determinations or form of relations between leaders and ranks, between the various layers, and within each layer tells the whole story. There is no content outside of that. Or once again,
Mike, hold on a second. Some people can't hear. Would everyone please make sure you've muted your mic? And Mike, will you tell us where you're reading from? And then if people have trouble, they can follow along.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of page 18. Can people hear me now? Hello?
I can hear you better. Can everyone hear him better? Can everyone hear him?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Take a look at the middle of 18 and Michael Reed.
So just to, not to go through the whole thing again, but she says that there is no content outside of that, that the form of relations between leaders and ranks, between the various layers. Or once again, to stick close to Hegel, the method, therefore, is both soul and substance, and nothing is either conceived or known in its truth, except insofar as it is completely subject to the method. So, I don't know if it's means determining the end, but or ends, but that seems to me to be pertinent. Over.
Hello? Okay, it certainly is quieter when everyone's muted, but then no one's speaking. Who would like the floor or table or whatever you're sitting at? Anyone else?
I've got another quote from Lenin. It's very short.
Okay, Ravi.
On the online version, page 87, it says, "We must come to the positive conclusion the strong revolutionary organization is absolutely necessary precisely for the purpose of giving stability to the movement and of safeguarding it against the possibility of making thoughtless attacks." And again, it's that idea of stability of the movement and not doing things thoughtlessly, which seems to be the need for theoretical clarity, which he talks about again and again, about the need to raise the theoretical level of the movement. And I'm not quite sure about how the passages that Mike read out resolve the problem that that's not already a reality. Over.
Stephanie, again, I didn't hear the page number. I'm sorry. Could you repeat it, please? Over.
Stephanie, you're talking about Ravi?
Yeah, 87 of the online version.
Did you get that? Page 87 of the online version. What have you done?
Okay, thank you. It's breaking up so that I can't always hear every syllable, and that makes it hard to hear page numbers even. Thank you.
All right. I think that we should move on. We're going to come back to the differences between Lenin and Donevskaya, no question about it, Ravi. I'm not trying to avoid that, and I'd like to say stuff, but I've already spoken, so, and we're an hour in. So let's move on to question three. Okay, near the end of her May 2053 letter, Dunayevskaya deals with the contrast between what Hegel called, quote, the mediation of the notion, which, quote, has the external form of transition, close quote, and, quote, mind itself, the new society, as the mediating agent in the process. And these quotes are from the second letter, the May 2053 letter, on page 28 to 30 of Power Negativity. So this is another three-part question. We'll take part A. How do these forms of mediation differ? And we get a little help from one of her late writings. See also page 336 to 7. Can we have someone tackle this?
Between the two kinds of mediation has to do with the first kind being tied to the element of necessity, and the second kind having to do with the realm of freedom. And it seems to me, just from reading the passages on pages 28 and 29, in part where she's explicating Hegel, in part where she's quoting from him, that the first kind of mediation, she's talking about the generation of nature, which of course is identified at least in this context with the realm of necessity. And of course in the second kind of mediation she's talking about mind, which of course is ultimately identified with the element of freedom. Over.
I've got a slightly different take on that, Ravi.
Okay, Ravi, go ahead.
Well, the first part is the objective elements in the existing society, which I took to read the crisis, breakdown, concentration and centralization of capital, all the things that are present in the existing society, but which have not been internalized and understood in their significance. And then the second part, in terms of what mind represents for Hegel, she parallels to the new forms of workers' creation, like the Commune and the Soviets, which are supposed to be mediations to a different type of society. So that they're both kind of foreshadowing the new, but one is on the basis of already what exists in the new society and points to the existing society and points to the need for a new. And the second mediation of mind is when the workers' act of creation forms the basis for like developing into the new and into a new kind of society. Is that kind of mediation? That's how I read it. Over.
Andrew?
Andrew.
Yeah, I think actually Both Paul and Ravi are saying the same thing. And I think it's basically, the way I read it as well, all the stuff about crisis and the logic of capital and, you know, dialectic of capitalist society is all about necessity. It's about objectivity. It's about the actual world, the way things are. And I think the importance of that is that this is how, so to speak, the movement for practice has been understood as being driven by that necessity. And that then gives the impulse to the so-called dialectic of the party in various forms, whereby the party needs to effect a transition from the spontaneous revolt to, you know, the idea of the new society. And that's basically the vanguardist idea. Or you reject that and you go along with spontaneity alone, and you say, well, the workers are spontaneously revolutionary. They're united discipline organized by the very mechanism of capitalist production itself. And that's all we need, and we just record the existence of, you know, what they do and how the movement's progressing. So, you know, if you think of logic here, logic is transition. It's mediation in the normal sense, where you start with something and you're trying to go somewhere else. You know, to a further goal or whatever, and you have to effect the transition, okay? And the mediation is the effecting of that transition. But the mediation of mind here seems to be self-mediated, which is really hard to grasp, but I think that that's what Hegel was saying, and I think that's what Dunayevskaya is picking up on. And let me see, page 29. Mind itself is the mediating agent in the process. This is the idea of the new society, as she's translating it, so to speak. So what is actually mediating everything, and I guess that means both the movement from practice and the movement from theory, is this idea of the new society. And, you know, on page 337, which is really near, it's re-quoting something near the end of the May 12th letter, instead of a transition, what we get is a free release of the idea. That's another way I think of putting this self-mediation. But it's very hard, I think, for all of us to understand exactly what that consists of. Over.
Okay, Andrew has answered question B, even though we were still on A, but that's okay, because it's the one to mind that's the unusual and interesting one, of it mediating itself. So let's see if anyone doesn't understand what she's talking about there at all. I don't mean that you understand all the Hegel, but do you understand the concept of a free release in which the mind or the new society develops on the basis of itself, no longer on the basis of rebelling against capitalism? Does anyone want to discuss that A and B further?
Anna, it's Paul. I do, but I'm going to hold back until I see whether others want to talk.
Okay. Anyone else want to jump in here and, as Raya says, leap, leap, leap? Or that was Lennon that said, leave, leave, leave. She says something similar.
Yeah, this is Brendan.
Yes, Brendan.
I don't know how to say this without destabilizing or interrupting the flow of what's supposed to be happening, but I don't think I understand anything at all about these two letters. I think I got a scale of 1 to 0. I get like a 1 to 10, I understand like 0 or maybe -1 from these two letters. As far as I can tell, Dunayevskaya is taking some concepts from Hegel and mapping them onto her exploration of the relationship of an organization to the masses. But I don't understand any of the Hegelian language that she quotes, so I don't understand then the conclusions she's coming to as she maps them onto her own process. I don't like the basic terms that she's dealing with, that she's quoting. I have not read Hegel's Logic, so I don't have a background in it. I'd love to read it one day, but I haven't read it. So all the basic terms she's dealing with, from absolute idea to mind to all these, everything that's in it, that starts with a capital letter, I don't know what it actually means. I can't make sense of the sentences. It's like reading Chinese. I've read it as slowly as possible through the letters, and I still don't get any of it. So I don't know if I'm missing something. Was there an expectation that people that haven't read Hegel's Logic are supposed to understand what's going on here? Or is there some shortcut one might be able to take to figuring out what's going on, other than to, you know, take a year and read Hegel's Logic and then come back to these letters? I'm at a loss for how to proceed from my current state of not knowing what's going on. Over.
Okay. Paul, do you want to come in here? Stick you with that one.
Actually, I'd be happy to. And I think I am sympathetic to Brendan's situation. First of all, it seems to me that we could make this a little easier. Self-mediation is a difficult concept, but it seems to me that it's tied to the notion of human practical critical activity, and therefore also it is tied to the notion of freedom. So the difference between self-mediation and not self-mediation is that self-mediation is carried out freely by a subject, whereas mediation is not yet free, but carried out at least momentarily within the realm of necessity. Now, the other point I want to make after Brendan has said what he said is this. I find it annoying that Raya uses Hegelian language the way she does. I know, and in fact she even says so explicitly in the text, I know that she's not falling into an idealist era. She's quite clear that she understands in order to interpret Hegel correctly, what we have to do is remember that we're always talking about real people. The people and the labor they engage in is the subject, the substance as subject. Why, and maybe, I'm just going to throw this out as a question. to those of you who are more familiar with what Raya was doing, why was she adopting Hegel's language, at least in these letters, as a way to communicate these ideas, when in fact Marx and Engels in early works such as The Holy Family and the German Ideology were quite explicit about how to sort of translate this stuff into a more materialist language, which quite frankly I think is easier to understand. When Andrew made his comment and said, hey, guess what, Paul and Ravi are saying the same things, I think he was right. I was trying to look at this as it was written in those two passages using the Hegelian language that she was using, and Ravi, of course, was trying to take the language and, you know, make it concrete by reminding us that we're dealing not merely at the level of theory, but at the level of practical critical activity. So I find this is an issue for me, in spite of the fact that I'm used to reading Hegel. I don't know why. And maybe, again, if anybody can answer the question why Raya thought it was necessary to adopt this language, I'd really be happy to hear the answer. Over.
This is Stephanie. I think I can maybe shed light on that as somebody who knows almost nothing, but because of what I've read, I could take a stab at it, unless someone more expert in Dunayevsky wants to go there. Over.
You can go first, Steffi, and then we'll see what happens.
Okay. I think it's because she felt that Hegel was the root of it all. She likes to use that word, the root, grasping things by the root, and that's radical. And it wasn't just a pose of hers that she struggled to get there. And I think that she felt that in terms of the history, you know, post-World War II history of what was going on with post-Marxist Marxists was that people were post-Marx Marxists, what people were saying, and that included, well, it went even before then, because it had to do with Lenin. But she herself referred to Lenin. And I think that she wanted, what she was seeking to do was to get people to know the source of where Marx's thoughts and philosophy came from, that even in his critiquing of his movement forward from Hegel, you know, whatever pure Hegelianism is or is not, that he still had his roots somehow there, and that he just didn't throw Hegel out completely, and that it was her way of reconciling in her own radical conceptualization of the world that was coming and the world that as it was, to use Hegel as a foundation. Over.
Anybody else before I take the floor?
I've got a quick thing on this, Anne. Ravi.
Okay, Ravi, quick.
I thought that it was mainly to deal with the fact that the main trend within kind of Marxism was positivistic, and during the early part of the 20th century, right up until when she was writing. So the recovery of the kind of critical spirit of Marxism meant that you had to challenge this, and going back to Hegel was the way in which she did it. And I think these letters are her really initially starting to do that, and trying to work through that language, which is, you know, it's fairly impenetrable, some of it, but, you know, she's having a crack at it, which is why those letters are her first kind of excited approach to them over.
I'm gonna say something. I think Steffi's on the right track when she says Raya's looking for the root of the movement of ideas. I think Paul's got it backwards when he says that why is she imposing this Hegelian language on what she's worked out about the movement of history or something. She isn't. She's honestly, fresh-facedly jumping into Hegel to see if he can illuminate what the hell's going on in the world. Because here the Russian Revolution has turned into its opposite, to use the Hegelian expression that Lenin brought to the fore much earlier on about the Second International and the trade union bureaucracy. The Russian Revolution has turned into its opposite. Everything looks bleak. The great revolts of workers don't continue on. She's looking for some ideas that can actually help. Go out in the world and help move movements forward in this two-way road that she discovers. The main thing she discovers in the study of Hegel is this two-way road between theory and practice. And she's looking to have them unite someday, and that will be when we enter the new society. And when we enter the new society, there will be an entirely new dialectic, the dialectic of freedom, and everything will be different. So that's what she's looking to. But she's not imposing it on a previously established philosophy that's worked out. She's trying to work out a new philosophy. And Marx did a very similar thing with Hegel. There's no question about it, although he didn't use Hegelian language. Unfortunately for us, Marx in fact wrote a long entry for an encyclopedia on dialectics, but it didn't get finished, and it didn't get published. But you can see the Hegel throughout Capital as well as other places, and he says in one of his or more of his prefaces or postfaces that Hegel is the key and master to all of this development. So we can't put the horse before the cart. She didn't write this for publication. She didn't write this for anyone except her co-leaders who were trying with her to figure out where the hell do we go next. Unfortunately, they ran the other way, not because they didn't know the Hegelian language. I don't blame any of you who having trouble with the Hegel. Nobody expects you to know it. We just thought you should take away a few key concepts from these letters about how Marxist humanism developed and about this movement from theory and movement from practice and what that means. So I don't remember who else wanted the floor. I'll end. Over. Nobody else?
Tora?
Andrew. Oh, go ahead, Tora.
Tora, you're first, because you haven't spoken.
Thank you. This is a guess. It's really just a guess. If Raya Dianevskaya wrote these letters for herself and her colleagues or friends or associates, maybe those letters were an attempt to get her own head around all this language, all this technical stuff. Over.
Andrew,
go ahead.
Yeah, I was mostly going to say what Anne just said, you know, Grace Lee Boggs had a PhD in philosophy, and C.L.R. James was the author on Notes and Dialectics. So it was written for them. But the other thing is Marxists are not opposed to Hegelian language. Generally, they use it all the time, contradiction this, contradiction that. The thing is, though, that it's in the doctrine of the notion in Hegel's logic where you get the development of the concepts adequate to freedom rather than that which is. That which is talked about in the first, two books. The third book is the doctrine of the concept of notion, and that's what they were trying to work on. It seems more Hegelian, probably, than the other stuff, just because it's unfamiliar. Over.
Anybody else? Oh dear. She's written so much about this, you know, there's so much, I can't begin to summarize it, but I'll try to write something. But she's points to where she's going with Hegel that Marx hadn't reached, because each age illuminates something new, and the dialectic keeps on rolling along, as it were. But don't take my word for it. You got to read much more of her. Can we address number C? What, if anything, does this have to do with the question of the proper role of a revolutionary organization? Okay, this is really a hard one, because the answer is, I don't think, in the text. I don't know. I didn't write this question. Anyone want to address that? What any of this has to do with the proper role of a revolutionary organization?
So I'll wait, but I could say something if no one else wants to.
Okay. It's only Paul and me so far that want to speak, and we've both spoken a lot. So let me just see. Can we hear from someone else? Even if it's only a question like, what the hell did she mean by this? If it's on this subject of this question three, it's fine. Come on in.
Shane.
Oh, okay, Shane, go ahead.
Yeah, with that kind of prompt, I mean, I think she's trying to figure this out, isn't she? That's, you know, in this is where she's first trying to figure out, well, what is our role if we have this idea that, you know, spontaneity and organization are opposites? Then we get rid of that vanguardist notion that we're the intellectuals are to deliver the truth, or to help workers organize to overthrow capitalism and introduce the new society, or bring that revolutionary consciousness, all that sort of vanguardist stuff. Well, then we are sort of back to the situation of going, well, C.L.R. James says, well, we just follow along and theorize what they do, or record what they do. And, you know, we said Donnie Sky wants more than that, but I think that's what she's trying to figure out. Okay, so what is the role? Are we, you know, supposed to give them lessons in Hegel, or what are we supposed to be doing? But, I mean, she doesn't say that, obviously, but that's where my sort of thinking is. It's like, well, where does that leave a revolutionary organization if you aren't going to be vanguardist and you're going to leave it to the workers to organize? But I think that's what she's trying to figure out. That's why this is a hard question to answer, I think. Over.
I have to say too, but I'll wait because I've talked a lot.
Yeah, wait, Steffi, because we got Paul, you, and me, we've all spoken. So let's just see if anyone else does, I think.
Yeah, Peter.
Peter? Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Could you turn the recording off, please, Will?
Okay, anybody else?
I've got another quick quote from Lenin.
can it wait till we get to another Lennon question or not?
Sure, yeah.
Oh, I'm not sure whether we have any today, but we certainly had a bunch of them here. Yeah, number 14. All right. Oh shoot, it's 5:32. It's okay because we're discussing the issues and we have next week also. But let me see, on this question, I think we have wanting to speak second time, Paul, me, and Steffi. Is there anyone else who wants to speak, particularly on this question C, which there's no right answer to? It's what, if anything, does this have to do with the role of a revolutionary organization? Anybody? All right, let's each keep our remarks brief, okay? Paul, you're first.
Briefly, I think Peter's answer was sufficient. Over.
Oh dear, you're breaking up. Did you say what Peter said is sufficient? Is that what
you
said?
It seems to me, again, that we're all breaking up. But in any case, that's what I said. In order
all right.
to be brief, I think Peter's answer was pretty on target. Over.
Okay. Is anyone else having trouble hearing?
I am. It's Stephanie.
Yeah.
Can't
hear. Yeah, I didn't hear that properly.
Oh, dear. Will?
Yeah, I just noticed that I might have been... unmuted. Does it sound like the Skype call itself is stuttering and freezing? Is that what people are hearing?
Yes. Over.
I don't know. It might be you, Will, if you were unmuted, because you were sounded funny just now when you spoke.
I do. Well, it might be. It's strange. For me, everything sounds pretty clear. I don't know why it would be doing. Why it would be doing differently for you guys. But if you'd like, I could try starting it again if we think that would be helpful.
This is Stephanie. I think you should start it again because it's consistent from here that everybody's breaking up. Over.
All right, I'll hang up and start again now.
All right, so we do nothing except you wanted to say something on this question. If you remember what it is.
Oh, I'm just in accordance with, I think it was Peter and Paul. Over.
Yeah, she is definitely trying to figure out the role of a small organization like she had in the JFT, and she continued working on that question for 30 more years until she died. As you know, she was writing a book on organization. But even though these letters are only a starting point of what has to be worked out, I think what's important to take away, aside from the tremendous revolution in revolutionary thought it was, to say there's a movement from practice to theory as well as a movement from theory to practice, and they're interpenetrating and they're developing together, and this is the dialectic of revolutionary activity as well as thought. They're not in separate compartments. Aside from that, specifically on the question of organization, which we're supposed to be addressing in these classes, I think she's trying to figure out how to overcome the split between theory and practice and therefore give a different role to organization. It seems to me, and I'm just guessing this, I just thought of this afternoon, throughout history, organization has been seen as only a minor term, an intermediary between an idea, an ultimate goal of socialism, and carrying it out, that it's just a conduit and nothing more. here I think she's saying something, she's hinting at or going towards something very different, because she starts to speak about absolute method and its importance. Oh, it's not in the letter, it's in her discussion of the letter in the Talking to Myself document from 1987 on page 337, where we've been visiting. Right, she sees something entirely new for organization in this concept of a mind, of the idea of freely releasing itself. Right, in the letter, the end of the second letter on page 30, she says, now that the idea is freely releasing itself in absolute mind, we've entered the new society. Here in 1987, she says, she repeats some of that, stand up and shout, the idea freely releases itself. But then the last paragraph of that little excerpt of writing to herself, she says, instead of placing a no entrance sign over organization as pure politics, end quote, pure politics, we finally are in the process of working out dialectics of philosophy and organization. All right, so it's as if everyone always relegated organization to just a political question without a direct relationship to the philosophy of the organization. I think that's what she's trying to break down. Okay, over for me. Anyone else on this question three? Okay, let's move to question 15, which is the next one. Oh, dear. No, there's nothing wrong with the question. I'm going to read question 15. What does Donevskaya mean when she contends that, quote, the party and forms of organization born from spontaneity are not absolute opposites? And that, quote, the absolute opposite is philosophy. And this is Power and Negativity, page 9. And see also her remark on page 6 about breaking with the elitist party politically without doing so philosophically, close quote. So what does she mean, and do you agree with it? We touched on some of this, but let's touch again. Who would like the floor?
Well, this is Ravi. I don't think I do agree with it. Over.
Okay, somebody else?
Shane?
Shane, is that you?
Yeah.
Okay, all righty.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure about the language, about absolute opposites and everything, but from what I get from what she means, you know, that Lenin, after the sort of betrayal of social democracy and World War One, he then, you know, goes back to Hegel, which seems like an odd thing to do. But there seems to have, he has some recognition that, you know, things move on and we need to understand this as a process, is how I, and he takes on board a whole lot of this sort of stuff, but then it doesn't impact on, you know, his notion of the vanguard party. So he does see it, in a sense, as a philosophical matter. We need to clarify the philosophy, but that doesn't necessarily impact on, you know, the forms of organization, even though he talks about state and revolution and every cook shall govern. He doesn't really get rid of the vanguard party idea. And what she's saying is, as I understand it at least, you know, that they've got the same problem in the sense that she's now got a hold of these ideas from Hegel and is trying to interpret things now. We're talking 1950, so it's clear now that the Stalinist counter-revolution has you know, corrupted the idea of socialism, and that we need to challenge all of that. And ultimately, the workers will have to settle matters with that. But, you know, they're only just getting to grips with the fact, okay, we don't want a vanguard party that takes over and creates what happens in the Soviet Union, but what does this mean philosophically? What does it mean for how we organise politically, and how do we think that through philosophically, rather than just, you know, saying we need a different kind of organisation? It needs to be consistently sort of thought through philosophically. That's my... So, yeah, the organisation has to embody those ideals and well, I don't like the word, but the vision that is required to bring about, you know, the vision of the new society and releasing all these new forces and new passions. That's part of, you know, what the organisation has to do, rather than just sort of deliver ideas to the masses so they can be organised and lead the revolution. Over.
Okay.
Andrew,
let me just see if anyone who hasn't spoken yet. We have a bunch of people who haven't said a word. All right, well, you go ahead, and then I'm going to inquire of other people. Go on, Andrew.
Yeah, the word absolute here means that it's transcendent. It transcends the opposition. And rather than you having two opposites, you know, contained within a certain problematic, that problematic here is, you know, spontaneity on the one hand, the party on the other hand. There are opposites within that problematic, but the standpoint of the absolute is the opposite to all of that, because it transcends that problematic. That's what's, I think, being said by absolute opposite. So the other opposite, spontaneity in form of organization, born from spontaneity, the spontaneous organization, they're opposite, but they're opposite sides of the same coin, so to speak. They have something in common that the philosophy does not. And so I just want to, like, reflect on what is it that these two things that seem to everybody to absolutely be opposite, what is it that they have in common? And it seems to me that what they both have in common is the notion of the masses being separate from, you know, apart from theory and philosophy. The spontaneous say, well, that's fine. And, you know, they're going to do it through activity alone and objective conditions alone. The very mechanism of capitalist production unites disciplines, organizes them, and that's all we need. The party people say, no, you know, we need our transitions, we need our organizations, we need our ideas to move them from that kind of consciousness to a higher consciousness. So there's a really profound similarity in those two positions. And when you get a rejection of that by Dunayevskaya, it's based on a rejection of what they have in common. This idea that the masses are, you know, unphilosophical, untheoretical, and the theory either needs to be brought to them from the outside or there's no need for it at all. And that, I think that once that's said, I think it's pretty clear why she then says that the absolute opposite is philosophy. But I want to shut up, and I'd love to hear from Ravi why he does not agree. Over.
I thought Ravi said he did agree. Ravi, are you there?
No, I said I didn't agree.
Oh, well, it's the static then. All right, do you want to tell us briefly why you don't agree?
Okay, I think I mean, I have raised this question before, and it's sort of been pointed out that in kind of saying that the masses only achieved trade union consciousness, that Lenin was writing them off. But I don't think that's the case. So if you look at page 68, again, the online version of What's to be Done, he says, "The time has come when Russian revolutionaries, guided by a genuinely revolutionary theory, relying upon the genuinely revolutionary and spontaneously awakening class, can at last, at long last, rise to full stature in all their giant strength. All that is required is for the masses of our practical workers and the still larger masses of those who dreamed of practical work when they were still at school to pour scorn and ridicule upon any organization that may be made to degrade our any suggestion that may be made to degrade our political tasks and to restrict the scope of our organizational work." Now, I think that for Lenin, even in What Is to be Done, he sees organization as the mediation between theory and the masses. It's not that it's a one-way street where the party tells the masses what to think. It is a continual dialogue in which the this is why I find it very difficult to understand why Dineshkaya thought her an organization like ours, that she refers to as your little grouping, was different to Lenin's concept of the party, because Lenin isn't talking about a mass party at the stage in which he writes What's Been Done. It is a revolutionary propaganda group, which is to try and theoretically develop a tendency which can outline what the tasks of the working class are at any given stage. And I know that you think that it's up to the working class to, you know, organize themselves, but if the theory doesn't come to them from the intellectuals, and it's not through an engagement with the intellectuals, who in turn have to learn from the masses, I don't quite know how the process is supposed to work. This is why I have difficulty with Dineshkaya's conception of it. It doesn't fully make sense to me. Over.
Okay, hold on. Okay, voices are still breaking up, I think. At least that one was to me. But let me, since we only have another 10 minutes, let's see what we can find out from the people who haven't spoken. If they would say something about what they're thinking about, that will help us decide what to address next week in our last class. So let me just ask, don't mean you have to answer this question or any question, but say something, please. Did Eric ever come in? Eric? No. All right, Stefan, we know you're there now. Let's see if we can hear you. You want to say something to us? Oh, Eric is here, but his mic isn't working. Okay, Stefan. Stefan, I cannot hear you. Could anyone hear Stefan? Oh, my God. Poor Stefan. He's been waiting all through every class to get his new mic, and now he's got it, and it doesn't work. Well, I'm glad you're here. I hope you can get your mic fixed or your money back, and you'll join us next week. All right. Who else have we not heard from that's here? Did we hear from Dave B? Are you there? Do you want to say anything?
I'm here, but I've got absolutely nothing to say, unfortunately. It's great listening to what everyone's got to say, but I've got absolutely nothing to add. Over.
All right. Did Sudeep ever come in? Are you there? No. And Ruchira? Will, you can answer for them, because I can't.
They never came.
All right, and David P. did not come, huh?
Nope.
So I guess that's everyone.
Torev?
Pardon?
Torev?
Torev, we know you're there. Do you want to speak on question 15?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay, take it away.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking along the lines that Andrew thought of. I was thinking that the party and other forms of organization born out of spontaneity, they don't necessarily, the common ground between that is, or between those, is that they don't necessarily have philosophy as a guiding principle. The party and the forms, the other forms, they have sort of the objective of making something happen out of the grounding, out of the context in which they emerged. And the philosophy by itself, per se, doesn't have anything to do with this, although it can be used for that purpose. Over.
Yes, indeed. Anyone else on question 15?
And it's Paul, but if you want me to wait, I will.
Yeah, just a minute. Does anyone else want to tackle this? Party and forms of organization born from spontaneity are not absolute opposites. Okay, Paul, go ahead.
As much as I could hear Ravi's response and objections to this, it took me back to something that was said earlier on, I believe, when reading Lenin about this notion of professional revolutionaries. And I couldn't help but think that history since Lenin has suggested that the problem with professional revolutionaries is that they either wind up substitutionalists or they wind up getting shot. I understand, I think, the counterposition of philosophy as the real opposite to this issue of spontaneity versus party or organization. My question about this, though, because I'm inclined to agree with this, but my question about this is, on the one hand, I know that the working class can, in fact, formulate and discuss philosophical questions on their own. So this brings us back to the question of the role of, for lack of a better phrase, a revolutionary organization like RIAS. And what it actually is supposed to be doing. It seems to me that it takes a special interest in the way in which workers come to formulate philosophical positions and ask and try to answer philosophical questions and try to engage in a kind of dialogue, precisely because, if we remember, Raya was asking the question, how come, you know, these little groups of intellectuals are already always sort of left over? And the answer is, I think, because they do know stuff that the working class hasn't yet worked out. Not that it can't, but that it does. That is, not that the working class can't work it out, but that these little groups of intellectuals do in fact already know things. Just like, of course, the class knows things that the intellectuals do not. So there's now a basis, it seems to me, for interaction between the organization, the little group on the one hand, and the class on the other hand, that's very different from the kind of approach that suggests that the primary function of a party is to engage in political organization, something which the masses themselves will work out largely through spontaneous activity. I don't know. Have I got this right? Over.
Okay. It's 6 o'clock here and some other ungodly hour where the rest of you are. So I don't think we should start another question. We've done only 3 of the 6 questions that we laid out of the 15 we wrote. So we're going to have to figure out if the rest of you have looked at all the questions, hopefully, and thought about them and done all the readings, you could drop us an email about which ones you think are most important to address next week. And we'll take that under consideration. In any event, we'll give you some indication of which ones we'll give priority to next week. Or if you want to, you know, write what you think we should be asking about Donevskaya, send us that. Does anyone who didn't just speak? I don't know how to put that anyone else want to say anything? But not if you just spoke. Well, all right then. I must say, I have to tell you, I think it's been a very, very exciting discussion. I think we grasped a few concepts that we didn't grasp in the beginning, and we can thank Marx for I'm having trouble now with my mic again. Andrew, do you want to say anything?
No, but you did get cut off in mid-sentence. I'd like to hear you, I heard, thank Marx for something or other.
Oh, I said Marx's critique of the GOAT program has illuminated a lot of Dunayevskaya and vice versa, I think. And that's good. That's all. I'm just speaking in platitudes, but I do want to tie all this in very specifically to the critique next week. Nothing else? All right.
This is Stephanie. It's a hardware question, very quick, low-tech. But it seems after page 337 for what was online for the power of negativity, the next page I have after that is 342. Is there more on, it's like on political divides and philosophic new beginnings? I don't have more text after page 337. Is that supposed to be that way or not? Over.
Yes, the on political divides and philosophic new beginnings is not a reading for these classes, although I encourage people to get the book and read it. The reason page 342 is there is because it has the footnotes for the piece that we read, the Talking to Myself.
Okay.
See, each of these little pieces is a separate, actually mostly fragments of things. But we didn't want to cut off the footnotes. Any other questions? Okay, well then, good night. We'll see you next week. As I say, please do write and tell us which of the questions you're most interested in or which of the answers you heard today are most problematic to you. I would love to see some discussion that actually concentrates on the issues Dostoevskaya has raised here and Marx has raised in the critique. So see you next week.